www.charlottetalks.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Before we start, I have two numbers, 38 and 0 and 13 and 0. Now we can proceed. Right after Haiti was crippled by a devastating earthquake in January of 2010, our guest today, Charlotte architect Ron Morgan, went there to see if he could help. He wasn't sure how, but he knew that people needed a sustainable way to feed themselves. So he sought the advice of a variety of people and came up with a radical idea, a self-sustaining aquaponic garden that would not only grow crops, but fish too. And I said that in the singular, but I really meant to say it in the plural. He calls his project 100 Gardens, and his idea has taken off. But recently, Ron received some devastating news of his own, a cancer diagnosis. His doctors gave him 21 weeks to live, and he is spending one of his precious hours with us in an effort to spread the news about 100 Gardens and to ensure that it will continue in his absence. Ron Morgan, welcome to the program. Good morning.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Ron has brought along some friends. Sam Fleming is co-founder of 100 Gardens, whose expertise is in hydroponics. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Hey, Mike.
And Monty Thompson is operations officer of 100 Gardens. He's an engineer with an expertise in food waste recycling, which is all part of this, which we'll talk about. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Mike.
Ron, let's start at the very beginning, in the aftermath of the earthquake in Haiti 5 years ago. I've read certain different accounts of this, but two Haitians knocked on your door. I read this account in Charlotte and asked you to go to Haiti. Did you know these two gentlemen?
I did. One was actually not a Haitian. It was Ted White, who's a minister and a friend of mine. He brought with him a Haitian minister who I had not met, and they just arrived cold at the door. And Ted knew me as an architect, and their church wanted to go on an excursion and consider building a new town, and they invited me to join them. I went along, and it was so devastating. We were there 2 months after the quake, and as you may know, 230,000 people died. Mm-hmm. That's like three Panther stadiums filled with people in about a minute. So it was not only a physical disaster, but it was socially everybody was hurt. They all lost a relative or something, and that's an important thing to consider when you think of recovery. So I looked at it all. I said, these people don't need – this isn't about master planning or doing new villages or anything. This is about how are these people going to feed themselves. And I just worked on that a little bit and struggled with it, and I thought, what if we could help them as a city? Certainly the UN's not going to step in, and it won't be the – United States of America to help them. Maybe it's a city helping a city. That was sort of the beginning of a question. And then the question expanded into, if you did that, maybe you could do it through the whole series of small gardens that you could ship and help them establish a new economy. So I came home with about that much of it in my mind, fiddled with it for a year, built a model, couldn't make it work, ended up Googling hydroponics, going to the store on Monroe, meeting Sam, who was simply open-minded and came over to my house and saw what I was trying to do with a mock-up. And then Sam said to me, what you're doing is really important. I've been saving up my money. I'll quit my job. He was a store manager. I'll quit my job and help you make this thing happen.
So there's a lot on that. Let's unpack that. You go to Haiti. Did you go to Port-au-Prince?
Port-au-Prince, right.
Why? Because obviously there weren't a lot of farms in the city of Port-au-Prince prior to the earthquake. Why did you feel that the countryside, which was largely unaffected by this earthquake, was unable to grow food and ship it into Port-au-Prince? Why did they need to grow?
That's a really good question, Mike. You know, their economy had been devastated by the rice policy that President Clinton had worked out, importing inexpensive rice from Arkansas and other places. So their agricultural economy was already on its knees, and it just seemed logical. I knew the story about Cuba coming up with a network of highly effective gardens when the Russians left and they had to fend for themselves. So that background thinking is what led me to the idea of many small gardens as opposed to trying to count on big-scale agriculture.
Now, that was in 2010. This is almost the end of 2015. How bad is the need today for this kind of thing compared to what it was when you went there in 2010?
I've only been there twice. Sam's been there more recently. From what I understand from my Haitian friends, they're really hurting. It's real hard going in Port-au-Prince.
Still, after all this time. Yeah. What does it look like today, Sam? When was the last time you were there?
I was there last June.
Okay.
And the thing about Haiti is that it's a really hot climate, and so you tend to see mostly staple crops being grown there, like rice and corn, but the corn doesn't really yield well because deforestation and the sloughing off of topsoil on the mountainsides has really depleted nutrients. Mm-hmm. And so the variety of crops is pretty limited, and then they can't grow things like leafy greens that well because it's so hot. So a lot of the vegetables that provide a lot of the vitamins are lacking in the Haitian diet.
Wow. So you go there, you decide that what they need is a way to grow their own food. How did you come up with the idea of aquaponics?
Well, actually, it's Sam's, because I was thinking hydroponics.
And the difference, I've explained the difference between
Sam,
the two.
Sam has corrected me after he offered to help make this thing work, and he said, and by the way, you need protein. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you got to use aquaponics because you can eat the fish and the vegetables, so you get a balanced diet that way. And I went, oh, wow. So we were on our way. And he knew all about it and still is.
But why did you think hydroponics was
hydroponics, simply, I didn't know anything about it. I just thought it was portable and doesn't use soil, so we could load. And what I mocked up and engineered was a shipping container filled with plastic pipes and nutrients and so on. You could set it up anywhere in a vacant lot, on a rooftop, and you could begin to produce food. But I was mistaken, because the fish is really the key to this in several important ways, and other people can talk about
that. It's an interesting story on so many different levels, because at first you turned to a guy named George Powell for this. And George Powell knew a lot about hydroponics.
He was an expert.
But he was also a homeless man.
He had run a hydroponic greenhouse, and was actually producing lettuce for Harris Teeter for about 12 years.
Really?
Yeah, and then when the highway came through, he was set up out in Matthews. He had an informal lease, and he ended up losing his greenhouse, so he went bankrupt, lost his house, lost his marriage, and lived up in the mountains like a Vietnam veteran. He was so hurt by the losses.
Right.
And he lived outdoors for a couple of years. So by the time I met him, because I go down to the Comet and listen to music, and he was there, and he was an old-timer. He was a basketball star at South Mech, and his dad was a coach at Myers Park. So he'd been around, but he was homeless, literally had been pushed out of a place that night when I met him. So I just put him up at my place till he could get his feet on the ground, and he turned out to be, and this is just a circumstantial meeting, probably the most informed hydroponic expert that you could meet. And so he and I engineered these things, and then he had cancer and he died. Mm. So I was left with a mock-up in my backyard, which was a comical sort of assemblage of pipes and things. I didn't know how to make it work, and that's when I met Sam. So George was an important person along the way.
You met Sam, as I understand it, because you went to this hydroponic store where you were the manager, and you were looking for some advice. What was it about Ron's story, Sam, that made you think, you know, it's a good day to quit my job and go and do this?
Well, honestly, I'd kind of been thinking about quitting anyways, but I wasn't at a point where I had a good reason to. And, you know, part of retail is customer service, and I found out pretty quickly in my early 20s that I was a really good salesman, and so I knew my people skills were good enough to maybe become a teacher in something I loved, such as hydroponics or aquaponics. So when he came in and said he wanted to do something in Haiti, I looked him up on the internet, and I found out that he had done all these amazing things around the city and around the region. So I thought, you know, if this isn't really a calling, you know, to be able to partner up with a guy who has experience mm-hmm. and be able to use my own skill set in a way that made me feel really good about myself.
I had no idea that there was a hydroponic store in Charlotte. How much of a call is there for this? Are there a lot of people involved in hydroponics on various different scales?
Yeah, there are. There's actually two in town right now. The one I worked for is no longer in business. So at one time, there were three in town.
So who were your customers? Were they ordinary people, or were they, I don't know, people who did this on a large scale, like to grow things for grocery stores?
They were mostly hobbyists. We sold hydroponics equipment and also standard gardening supplies. Mm-hmm. So we had people doing hydroponics on a small scale, either inside of their house or in their backyard. And then a lot of our customer base was people that were just backyard gardeners who wanted to support a local business.
So hydroponics uses water and only water, I guess, in a tank.
It uses, well, basically you make a fertilizer solution out of minerals.
Okay.
And so you combine different mineral compounds together to make a complete fertilizer to feed plants.
And but they grow in the water with no soil.
Yeah, they grow in various ways with no soil. And basically, if you can pass the water, the fertilizer solution over the plant roots and provide enough oxygen, then they can thrive.
And why is that better than growing plants in the ground?
I would not say it's better in every situation, but it's another way to grow food in places that have destroyed soils mm-hmm. or in dense urban areas where there's no arable land.
And I read yesterday that hydroponics uses 90% less water than traditional agriculture.
Yeah, that's true. And that's in comparison to big-time agriculture such as soybean and corn production, where they have overhead sprinklers that spray down hundreds of thousands of acres at a time.
So given the climate change that we're experiencing and drought conditions in the breadbasket that we're experiencing and the decline of the aquifers in most of the American South and in places like India and China and elsewhere, where water is becoming really scarce and threatening agriculture, is this an option on a gargantuan scale since it uses 90% less water? Is this an option?
I think it is an option. Obviously, we don't know yet, but the way I see it is if we encourage sustainable technologies like this, they'll get further refined mm-hmm. and they'll start to make even more sense on a larger scale.
You're the engineer here, Monty, and the operations officer of 100 Gardens, and we'll talk about why it's called 100 Gardens a little bit later on. But is this difficult to do? Does this require a lot of machinery and equipment and people who understand how to operate it and sit there at dials and or does it pretty much run itself once you get it up and running?
No, it's a complex system. Mm-hmm. And we're actually on the beginning of this technology. I mean, it was discovered in the Virgin Islands.
Discovered?
Yeah, discovered. When tourists would go down the Virgin Islands, they had they wanted to fish, and they want to eat fish. Mm-hmm. And the fisheries around the island had been fished out. And so, they put their heads together. Actually, Sam trained with one of those guys down there and probably could speak better to it than I could.
Well, essentially what it was they started – if you notice, tilapia is a really popular fish now to buy, but – do you remember seeing it 20 years ago?
No, never heard of it 20 years ago.
Well, after the global fisheries have been in decline, fish farming started to become on the rise to meet the global demand for seafood products, even though we didn't have as much seafood. But the problem with fish farming is it pollutes the environment because you have so much waste being produced in a small amount of water, and then that ends up in the streams and rivers.
And so when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about how this aquaponic method not only solves that problem, but we'll find out where the fish come in as food.
Sure.
In a second or two. We're talking about 100 Gardens. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Novant Health Cancer Center, providing customized treatment plans and a team of professionals to help give patients the support they need. Information available at novanthealth.org/cancer. You know, we're just shy of a year before the November election, and in just the last couple of weeks, politics has begun to really heat up, from the presidential candidate's remarks to issues that are beginning to emerge in the North Carolina governor's race, the changes in city council positions being made by our new mayor. So we're going to sit down with some political junkies to take us through the most important happenings here and around the country as we head toward the end of the year and get us up to speed on all of this. We'll do that tomorrow morning on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a new poll shows Americans are more afraid of terrorism than at any time since 9/11. Plans to boost security include revamping the threat warning system and tightening visa waivers, assessing security in the U.S. and whether more should be done.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about 100 Gardens, which is kind of the brainchild of Ron Morgan, architect, urban designer, artist. In fact, he is auctioning off some of his prints at Elder Art on Thursday evening at 6 to support 100 Gardens. Ron Morgan is a remarkable guy because he, along with Terry Shook and Gaines Brown and others, are kind of the masterminds behind a lot of the things that we've come to enjoy in Charlotte and around this area, including the development of South End and the marvelous greenway around the Reedy River. I think it's called the Reedy River in Greenville, South Carolina, and places in Catawba College and I think name some other places that you've worked. As I look through this booklet, it's amazing.
Well, as I said, most Rock of it Hill. Was done in Greenville, but mm-hmm. I've worked in Morganton, did a city hall there.
Salisbury.
Pardon me?
Salisbury.
Salisbury, did a couple buildings there.
You're kind of a visionary.
Well,
you have the vision, and then people help you realize that vision.
Well, the reason I traveled around the region is people get impatient and have had enough of me, so I got to go find a new town.
and it was his vision when he went to Haiti that these people need to feed themselves, and I think one of the ways we can feed them is through hydroponics, which is now segued into aquaponics, and that is where Sam Fleming has come into the picture. He's the lead designer and engineer and co-founder of 100 Gardens, and Monty Thompson is also with us, an engineer and the operations officer of that outfit. Aquaponics has been described as a sustainable way to produce food. And aquaponics adds one extra ingredient to the hydroponic story, and that is the fish.
Yep.
What role, aside from, I guess you could pluck the fish out and, and eat them as protein, what role do the fish play?
Well, they are generating the fertilizers for the hydroponics that would normally be the mineral-based nutrient solution that I was talking about earlier. So we feed the fish a vegetable-based diet that's formulated sort of like, chicken feed or mm-hmm. pork feed. And once you feed the fish, then they excrete waste, mm-hmm. and you manage the amount of food that you're giving the fish to produce a certain waste profile that suits the plants. And that's all been figured out with formulas. Then the plants remove those nutrients from the water, cleaning it to be returned back to the fish. So when we're talking about how fish farming tends to pollute, this is really a way to prevent that, because instead of that waste stream going out to a river or into a sewer, it's now going and getting treated by vegetable crops and cleaned up.
And some of the problem with fish farms, as I understand it, traditional fish farms, and at least in the past, has been the fact that the fish are essentially living in their own waste. And that's not a very healthy thing for the fish, and it's not very healthy for us to eat those fish. But this is a system, it's a closed system, mm-hmm. that continually, it's a symbiotic relationship. The plants clean the water goes back to the fish eat the food, they excrete the waste, the plants use the waste as fertilizer, it cleans the water, and it goes back to the fish. It's brilliant.
Well, we didn't invent it, like I said, or like Monty alluded to. This kind of technology has been used for thousands of years. We're just modernizing it now.
Well, he just said it was discovered. But you're saying it's been around for thousands of years. How come we just discovered it? It's like discovering America. There were people here first. So how did we discover it?
Well, I think when he said discovered, we discovered the modern way to do it. But Monty, if you kind of want to describe some evidence of it in the historical context.
So one thing we know that we talked about, tilapia. Mm-hmm. Well, the fastest growing fish that we can use in this kind of a production is tilapia. And not only just tilapia, there are different types of tilapia. One of them is the Nile tilapia, because it can grow in brackish water in the Nile. And I have been there and went through the pharaoh's tombs there in the pyramids, and they actually have emblazoned in the pyramid there the tilapia that they would raise there. So
did they raise them aquaponically? Is that what you're saying?
Well, we know that in Southeast Asia, in their rice fields, they do put koi and carp in their rice fields, and the farmers actually know how big, how much water, and how many carp to put in there to increase their yields, to get better drought resistant if it happened, or pest resistance. Those fields, those rice paddies were healthier. Same in South America, in the Andes, and down in the Inca area. It appears that we think they use that technology. Now we have in the Bible the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. So here you are out in the desert in Persia on the Silk Trail. How are you going to feed those people coming through there? How did you feed them building the pyramids, that many people? Mm-hmm. And we think it was aquaponically, that in the Gardens of Babylon came a reservoir lake, and they would look at the fish in that lake to make sure it was abundant enough to feed the plants in the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. There.
Hmm.
So actually, historians are actually rethinking how that all worked.
Really?
Yeah.
So what kinds of plants seem to do well in these aquaponic situations, at least the ones you're trying?
Yeah, certainly you want leafy greens. It's kind of difficult, but you can do it. And as technology advances, we can look at root crops like potatoes or carrots. But we're looking at crops above the, you know, float tank.
So they would be what? Lettuces and what else?
Lettuces,
cabbage.
Kale, cabbage. Tomatoes are great. I mean, tomatoes are just delicious out of an aquaponic or hydroponic garden. We know the nutrient content is, you know, real good. I mean, it's really better for you. It grows faster. There's less resistance. The soil is not there, so the roots go down in the water, and we bring the feed to the roots. So there's no struggle there. The energy is put into the production of plant.
Mike, let me flip this now. I want to flip this coin to another side, because one of the things we realized along the way is that we had our minds on food, but once we started the operations at Stonewall Jackson for the kids in prison, juveniles, we realized that it really wasn't about food production so much as it was education, and that this semi-closed-loop system and the way it worked and all the things we're talking about right now opened up kids' minds in ways that was, like, extraordinary. We began to see these kids in prison just come alive and be creative around all these things. So what the shift for us was is that we had discovered an educational mechanism, and that's really where we're headed.
Now, you've opened a brand-new door in this conversation that we haven't talked about yet. So people are going, what? Schools? Yeah. Prisons? What are you talking about?
I'm messing with your
show. Okay. No, it's okay. It goes where it goes. You have built prototype labs or prototype systems at Garinger High School, also in Fort Mill, also at Stonewall Jackson Training School in Concord, which is a juvenile detention facility, at South Iredell High School, and you're forming a training center in Charlotte.
Right.
How did this happen? Here you are coming back from Haiti, deciding we need to feed these people or help them feed themselves. I'm going to turn to aquaponics. I find George Powell, then I find Sam over here, Sam Fleming, and then we start working on this. But let's put these in schools in Charlotte. How does that work? That seems like a detour.
It takes a couple steps. Admittedly, we've had some magical things happen. One of them was a state of North Carolina called up Sam's store, and they wanted some plumbing installed in an old abandoned greenhouse. And Sam talked them in to doing an aquaponic training center. I don't know how he did it, but he did. And they said, "Let's go for it." And so Sam designed the first one, and I kind of watched in awe, and we all helped him build it. And he laid it out with these different workstations and testing areas and so on. And I'll be darned if it just didn't work like a charm. Mm. And then we began to realize what an important educational tool it was.
So you are.
So that's how it started.
You're an aquaponics evangelist, evidently, Sam, because you've gotten people in a juvenile detention facility to allow you to install this. And Ron mentioned the educational value of this. What are you seeing in these young? I guess they're primarily young men in this facility, right?
Yeah, for sure.
What are you seeing in them as they work with aquaponics?
Well, it's more about working with your hands and having a tangible result from what you're learning in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So when you're managing an aquaponics system, there's a couple of disciplines that you have to learn. You have to learn some basic biology. You have to learn, about fish biology, about basic plant biology. Then you go into chemistry, testing pH, nitrogen levels. And then you're managing, essentially, an ecosystem. So when you change a parameter, it affects everything in different ways, dynamically, the way life works. It's not a linear process. Mm-hmm. And so the thing I've noticed mostly is that it's really just engaged students in a way that other teachers said they're not having success
and
with.
And this is happening in the traditional schools that you're in as well. It not only, I guess, exposes them to the practical application of science, which is something that seems to be devoid in a lot of cases. That's why they don't like it, because they don't see any reason for it.
Sure.
But this shows them how it works. We all live in this ecosystem called Earth, and we're kind of screwing it up. We've been screwing it up for years. Does this bring it home? Does this help shed a broader understanding? If it works this way in an aquaponic environment, it must work this way on the planet.
It changes the way you think.
And I think one of the things that you can – as a young man in Stonewall Jackson, you start nurturing these plants and engineering how they're going to grow. And so what does that take? It takes light. It takes nutrients. So we can apply it to themselves. You know, well, what does that take for you to be successful? You know, one of the great – we had a tour going through Stonewall Jackson and they were people from around the state in the prison system, and one of them asked one of our students, well, now that you know how to operate this system, what do you want to do when you get out of
right.
detention? And he said, you know, I want to open a motorcycle shop. And everybody kind of was taken back, and, well, gosh, you've got this great skill. And he says, well, what I learned was that I can do just about anything I want if I just apply myself. You know, if I just focus on what I'm doing and how it works, and he says, so I think I can rebuild motorcycles.
Huh. Well, I mean, you take things from things that you learn and you can apply. That's smart, actually. The fish are there, as we said, to provide nutrients for the plants. The plants clean the water to give clean water to the fish. But part of your plan is to take some of the fish out and eat them.
Sure.
And you take the plants out, obviously, and eat them. And when you do that, it seems to me that you're throwing the system
out of balance.
So well, that, how do you do that?
Well, it's called staggered production, essentially where you're growing different age groups of plants. So when you harvest, you're not harvesting the whole water treatment part of the system, which is the plants. And same with the fish. So we usually set up multiple tanks of fish. So when we have a harvest, we're not harvesting any more than 25% of the population.
So are these in separate tanks? Do the fish swim amongst the plants, or does the fish water get pumped into the plants?
Yeah, it's compartmentalized.
So how do you control the circle, I guess, for lack of a better term? How do you – yeah, because it's a circulation
cycle.
Thing.
Yeah.
The cycle. How do you control
There's a pump.
That?
There's a water pump that pumps water into the fish tanks. And then they drain by gravity into a filtration unit that just removes solid waste.
Mm-hmm.
And then the nutrient-rich water comes out of those filters, and that flows by gravity through the hydroponics component.
How long does that take?
Typically about 3 hours.
And before electricity, when the Egyptians were doing this and the Hanging Gardens of Babylon may have done this, they didn't have pumps. They did it all by gravity?
Elevation, yeah.
Slaves.
And they were also doing it – they're also doing it extensively. They weren't doing it for high yields the same way we are. So when you do intensive agriculture, you tend to be relying on electricity.
So these units that you have at these various schools and the ones that you're putting in Haiti, how big are they? What are they in? Do you have to actually build the container?
That's another challenge that we had to face. And what was interesting is one of our projects is in St. Vincent's Orphanage.
In Haiti,
mm-hmm. right downtown Port-au-Prince. 60% of them are either blind or deaf, and the other 40% are crippled severely. And they're crammed, since the earthquake, they're crammed in a small space. So there really wasn't a big space to do aquaponics, but they wanted to try this because of a big grant they could get if they used aquaponics in there, and that's how we got involved. So we looked at the situation and how could we do that. And I went down there with Sam, and they gave us a couple of options. And one that they gave us, they wanted us to do it, was far away from the orphanage. And luckily, I started building there, but Sam came in and said, no, we've got to get this. Take it right into that orphanage. So I go, let's go look at it. It's so cramped in there. I mean, there are literally three tiers of beds vertical, and it's just they're packed, and the playground is just packed with kids when they break. And so we found this little cubby hole that the doctor Sonnenier said we could use. And so Sam went back to Stonewall Jackson, and those boys designed a 55-gallon drum system with five drums, just a small little float tank to circulate it, and some low-power circulating pumps. And we put it in a week.
And I understand that one of the continuing challenges in Haiti is the unreliability of the electric power.
So we told them about that you need a circulating pump, you know. And they said, oh, well, let's go ahead and try it. And that's what this prototype was for anyways, just to get excitement and teach the kids how to take water samples, how it works. Use this, you know, a whole language had to be developed because most of them were deaf, or a lot of them were deaf. And so they said, "Well, let's just put it in anyways." So we put it in. About 30 days after we left, they had a power outage. Everything stopped. Some tanks overflowed, and they said, "Oh yeah, we need to get a solar system in." So we actually have one now in a 5-gallon bucket that we're perfecting that we can sit on the side, and it's got a battery back.
Is that the only prototype you built, or did you build prototypes? Or do you consider all of these things that you've installed in various schools as prototypes for a larger
The ones we have in schools are a bit more refined because we've gotten better. And now we're designing them to reflect the curriculum that we've been trying to develop.
I mean, given the fact that this has been around for centuries, and you worked at a store, one of three stores at one time in Charlotte that dealt with this, why do you need a prototype? Why don't we know how to do this from the get-go?
That's a really good question. And like I said, here in the States, we have a standard design. When we go to Haiti, it's too expensive to ship the materials to Haiti. And then sometimes your stuff could be stuck at customs, and you could be liable to be bribed to get your stuff through customs. So what we did when we went to Haiti is develop it all out of locally sourced materials. And so that's why it's kind of been a prototype over there, to figure out what materials work and what's going to be the issues with it.
That's Sam Fleming, who's the co-founder of 100 Gardens. We'll talk about why it's called 100 Gardens. Also Ron Morgan, co-founder of 100 Gardens as well, an architect and urban designer and artist. And Monty Thompson, engineer and operations officer for the organization. We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Bojangles, featuring the holiday family feast, including chicken made from scratch biscuits, fixins, and freshly steeped iced tea. Bojangles, serving the Carolinas since 1977. Negotiators reach an agreement on combating climate change. So what's in the deal to curb greenhouse gas emissions, and what does it mean for governments, industry, and the environment? They'll take up those questions and a few more, no doubt, on the Diane Rehm Show coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can reach us at WFAE through Facebook or Twitter, or you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. And I want to remind you about the art auction of Ron Morgan prints coming up this Thursday evening between 6 and 9 at Elder Art in Southend. We're coming right back.
I'm News Director Greg Collard. Thank you for your support of WFAE. You've helped put our reporters and stories from our region on the national map.
From member station WFAE, Michael Tomsick reports.
Duncan McFadden from member station WFAE reports.
Lisa Wharf reports from member station WFAE.
This year, our reporters produced nearly 30 stories that went national. As the end of the year approaches, you can demonstrate your support with a tax-deductible contribution. Go to WFAE.org for details.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about 100 Gardens. That is a project of Ron Morgan. He's the fellow who came up with this idea to help people in Haiti by aquaponically growing food to feed themselves. He ran to Sam Fleming, who quit his job to become a co-founder of this and a lead designer and engineer on the project. And Monty Thompson is also with us. He's an engineer and the operations officer of 100 Gardens. By the way, our guest today, Ron Morgan, is the Charlatan of the Week today.
Congratulations.
All right, Ron.
On Charlotte Agenda, which is a nice little feather in your cap. Let's get back to how this all works. You were talking about how you had to do prototypes because in Haiti to bring in stuff is a challenge because of customs and because of attempted bribery. You're trying to help these people. This is one of the continuing problems in Haiti. The people, the aid that has gone to Haiti in the aftermath of that 2010 earthquake sometimes didn't get to where it was supposed to go because of corruption.
Yeah.
How bad have you found this to be? How difficult have you found it to be to work with the people you're trying to help?
Well, luckily, we have really good connections through Haitians that live in Charlotte. And so when we were taken down there for the last two projects, the project had already been sold to the entire community. And I actually had to get up and talk in front of 4,000 Haitians at a church service every Sunday, who all knew who we were. And so we were accepted immediately because the leaders of the community invited us in. So it hasn't been hard working directly with community members. But in terms of the aid, to give you an idea of how bad it is, in the middle of Port-au-Prince, you'll find all the T-shirts that are donated being sold to people in markets. And so you'll see a 2003 Carolina Panthers Super Bowl champions T-shirt that was rejected and sent to Haiti being sold to people who it should just be given to. And T-shirts are a whole thing because they don't really do a whole lot in terms of aid,
right,
except for make us feel good about ourselves. But it's pretty bad.
This is such a broad thing because it started out as an idea to help people in Haiti, and somehow it got not sidetracked. That's not the right word, but you decided to put this in schools, and as I mentioned, you put it in Fort Mill, at Garinger, at South Iredell High School. Cynthia Marshall is just happened to be in our little studio audience here at Spirit Square today, and she's with Communities and Schools. I take it this has been helpful to Communities and School, this project.
Absolutely. You know, Communities and Schools is all about engaging students and trying to perhaps change the environment in which they live and work. And this is very exciting because I have seen firsthand how the students at Myers Park High School and some of our elementary school students who are involved in traditional gardening are really more excited about school. They're learning how to read in a different way. They're learning how to write in their journals. They're doing math in the garden. And then the best part, one of the best parts, is that they're learning how to really take it, as Alice Waters says, from seed to table.
Mm.
They're growing it, harvesting it, and then cooking it and learning what it's like to taste fresh food.
Yeah, they're reconnecting to something we've kind of lost touch with.
Yes.
How food gets to the table, and you're right, what it tastes like when it really is fresh. There's a big difference between a store-bought tomato and one you grew.
Absolutely,
in the
and the nutrient value, not just taste, the nutrient value.
Is it raising grains?
It is. I mean, I have seen research that has shown that when students are involved in this, their behavior improves.
Mm.
Their attendance improves because this is an exciting part of their day.
But, you know, plants don't grow overnight. They grow very slowly. I thought about this over the weekend. They grow very slowly. So you put one of these gardens into production, and you got a couple of fish, and you got a couple of, I don't know what the plants are they seedlings?
Yeah, they are.
When they go in. And it's not like you put them in on a Tuesday, and on Wednesday you can eat the lettuce. It takes a long time. How do you maintain interest in a student? Because they're, let's go, come on, let's push a button on my pad, and yeah, we'll play this game.
Well, I have seen Sam Fleming in action at Myers Park High School, and he has the statistics class comes out, and they actually measure and weigh the fish on a regular basis. Then they feed that information back to the horticulture class at Myers Park, and that's how they regulate what kind of food is given to the plants. So there is always a constant conversation, and because it's so dynamic, you can just visibly feel the excitement when you walk in the greenhouse with them.
Cynthia, thank you. Now, I know that your vision here is to have 100 gardens, many of them here in the Charlotte area, I think, what, 67, I think it's the number that rings a bell, and 33 in Haiti. Why isn't the number flipped? Why isn't it 67 in Haiti and 33 in Charlotte?
Well, our idea in the beginning was to have some continuity in an educational sense. So we're coupling together a middle school and a high school and then connecting that to a garden, which is really a training center in Haiti. So you think of a pen pal or sister cities. This is one where a middle school and a high school would have a sister garden in Haiti.
And what's the value of that?
Well, the value is that we're going to have them hooked up technically so you can communicate with one another. So you have a learning experience based on real science and a real hands-on experience.
So they'll be sharing
information.
Best practices?
Right. So why are your tomatoes yellow? Your pH is off. Your iron content's too low. The kids can have that kind of a conversation. Plus, with Skyping, we can actually watch the kids in the garden there and vice versa.
Huh.
So we do them in these triangles of three, and we do 100. We just picked 100 because it's provocative, but it turns out to be a pretty nice goal for us.
How much food can you grow, and how many fish can you harvest, and how long does it take? I understand the Aqua Lab at Garinger High School puts out 200 heads of leafy greens a week. That sounds like a lot to me, is it?
That's only in a system that takes up 224 square feet. So it's a very small space. The plants grow in 30 days.
So just transplant. About every foot is a plant.
There's four plants per square foot.
Wow.
If you think about what a head of romaine lettuce looks like,
right,
if you were to stack them correctly, you could get four in a square foot.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with kale and other similar leafy greens.
So they're turning out 200 heads of leafy greens a week and 1,000 pounds of fish a year.
Well, we could push out 1,000 pounds of fish a year. We have the capacity to, but we have learned in the last year that the management it takes to push out that kind of production on the fish is really too much for the teachers and students there.
Mm-hmm. In Haiti, is the plan to have this administered professionally or to put it in schools? And if so, why? Because it seems to me if people in Haiti need a method of feeding themselves, why not build these things for professionals and let them become professional farmers, aquaponic farmers?
Well,
that's pretty much it.
When you asked about a prototype, the thing I learned about going to Haiti is it's so different culturally. It's everything in Haiti is so much different. And for me to assume that I had the right answer would be ignorant. So our goal for Haiti is to show people the basis of the technology and build a couple and then let the experts and the farmers and the engineers in Haiti mm-hmm. who live there optimize it for their conditions. So right now we have two in Haiti. We've had some issues keeping them up and running, but we're okay. And we just feel like we can let the Haitians refine the technology.
Bill in Matthews says, doesn't aquaponics give you essentially the same result as naturally occurring wetlands, which clean the waters while providing sources of food? Are your guests looking at wetland areas to grow their enterprise?
That has been mentioned. There's a lot of interest in it, but I personally have never seen an example of that.
Okay. And Dawn on Facebook says, I presume this technology is scalable to home garden applications. Any tips for a home gardener? And that's how you started with this, isn't it?
Yeah. And my tip would be to Google aquaponics in Australia because the Australians really took this up in the 90s after they had major water restrictions. But yeah, there's people that build a system that only takes up 20 square feet, and they're providing fresh produce.
I was going to say, and you could go to the website, 100 Gardens website, and Sam is going to be giving classes there in the neighborhood at around 36 in Noda.
Yeah, it's
everybody's welcome. He's going to do a little home system.
The website is
100gardens.org.
And it's 100.
Yeah, numerical.
Gardens.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Even in this country, we have food issues. Obesity is a major problem here because people are eating the wrong stuff and too much of the wrong stuff. And there are food deserts where it's impossible to get fresh produce and access to good, nutritious food. And you say, Monty, I did not know this. This is shocking, actually. You say that food simply isn't as nutritious today as it was in our grandparents' day, that it would take to get the same nutrition from the one orange that my grandfather would eat, you'd have to eat 9 oranges. What's going on?
I think I misspoke. It was 7 oranges.
Well, even so, what's going
on? Keep growing here.
Yeah, well, it's common knowledge. You can Google us anywhere. But, you know, the agribusiness is designed for production, to get that crop on the market at a certain time. It's got a certain growing period. We're going to come right behind it with another crop. The seeds are developed for high yield. They're not developed for nutrient value. The soil is – that's my expertise with – we didn't have a chance to get into that. But the soil has been depleted, so now they go to chemical fertilizers, which don't provide the nutrient.
And you're an expert in food waste recycling. It seems to me that
well,
this is the perfect storm of that.
Yeah, he's the man.
Candidates who have passed the Mecklenburg County mm-hmm. composters class. And
you're
it's a
licensed
great
to
enlightening
do this. Yeah.
class.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we can actually take spent food, you know, the uneaten portion of your plate or whatever, and we have a program we're doing at Stonewall Jackson where we ferment that in 30 days. It's back in the garden, not like traditional composting.
Now, Ron Morgan, you are a man who's made many contributions here to this region through your profession as an architect and a kind of a visionary. And we talked about some of those projects in historic downtown Salisbury and the Catawba College and also around Greenville and here in South End. You helped to have the vision for those projects and help to see them through. And now you're leaving this legacy, this aquaponic legacy here in the school systems here, but also in Haiti. And I say legacy because as I started this program, we mentioned that you had been diagnosed with cancer.
Right.
And it's a terrible diagnosis. If a doctor sits down and gets close to your face and says you have 21 weeks to live, the first thought that goes through your mind is likely not to be, well, we've got to see this aquaponic thing through. I'd be going to some wonderful place on the planet and just blowing it out. You've taken a whole different approach. How do you explain that?
Funny you say that because a number of people said, well, why don't you go here or there, Paris and things. But I love what I do, and I've gone to a lot of trouble to do what I love. So I was right at the in the middle of this project working with these – I mean, working with fabulous people, and we really feel like we're onto something that's profoundly important, so it's not superficial. I mean, we're really serious about what we do. And so I get the judgment of 21 weeks, which was based on real statistics.
How long ago was that?
Oh, it was about, 5 or 6 weeks ago.
Okay.
And, you know, you have an initial reaction. It kind of hits you like a bolt. You can feel it in your bones when you realize what he's saying. And then you have your moments where you know, Jane and I have been married for 52 years, and so you got this, the sort of the tender part of it, and then you get past that. I mean, you only cry about it for so long, and then you say, well, gosh, now I got 21 weeks. It's kind of an exciting opportunity.
And yeah, you said that this is the fact that they gave you a timeline, it was kind of a gift.
Extraordinary, really. It's a blessing.
Really?
Because now you know something, and, you know, I'm working on something I'm really important and love, and all these great people I'm working with. So I just got them all together and said, you know, I've got 21 weeks. Here's my plan, and if anybody can help me move it along, let's get going. And everybody jumped into it, and I've got extraordinary genius people all around me. And so now we're just – and here's my purpose, though. When I reflected on what the options were and what my choices were, the one thing I wanted to do about this work was to get it grounded and rooted in a financing structural way so that when I'm gone, this thing will have a life of its own. And so that's what we're setting out to do. The gallery art auction is part of a broader strategy about how the arts can contribute and essentially become have monetary value to help create a science project. So this is a kind of an interesting closed loop in which the community can take the lead through the arts, and then the foundations and the corporate sponsors and so on can follow. So this is a community-driven it's pretty unique in that sense.
Nonprofit.
So it's a nonprofit, so it's not about...
So this art auction, which is at Elder Gallery on December the 17th from 6 to 9 p.m., December 17th, 2015, that will provide some income to this project? Are there other ways that people get involved?
Well, all the art goes to the one goal, which is to build what we call Aqueous One, which is our new model for the sort of an ideal facility. It's great, big greenhouse, beautifully finished, mm-hmm. with all the backup classrooms and technology. It's meant to be a prototype, repeatable, and we'll build 60 more of them around the region.
Of all the things that you have contributed to in this region and over your life, your professional life, because you're originally from Berkeley, California.
Berkeley, I grew up in Berkeley.
So this is your adopted home, but a lot of the things that have bloomed here in terms of development are your brainchild. All these things that you've been part of, what's the most important? Is this the most important?
Well, I'd almost rather go back and say why the community is so extraordinary.
But 10 seconds.
And it's the can-do attitude of Charlotte that made me want to come here, and the leadership when I first arrived.
That's Ron Morgan, founder of 100 Gardens, an architect, urban designer, and artist. Also with us, Sam Fleming, co-founder of 100 Gardens, and Monty Thompson, the operations officer for that organization. Thank you all for the honor.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.